Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Over the past few years, we've had my cousin, Tom Stella, on, because Tom is a bright guy who has his finger on the pulse of spirituality in America, something I'm sure he would probably very humbly deny, but his books speak for themselves. He's been on Common Threads talking about his first book, The God Instinct, then A Faith Worth Believing, and Finding God Beyond Religions. He has a new book now, which is called CPR for the Soul, and it wouldn't be a book event without an appearance of Tom Stella on Common Threads. So we welcome once again Tom Stella. Let me tell you a little bit about my cousin. He's been sharing his spiritual wisdom with the world for years, and he has been with the Congregation of Holy Cross, and he has ministered to thousands of people in parishes, hospitals, hospices, and on campuses for over 30 years. He's the co-founder and director of Soul Link, Inc., a spiritual director, a retreat facilitator, a corporate chaplain for Centura Health, which is a Catholic and Adventist health system headquartered in Denver, Colorado. He holds a Master's of Divinity degree from Notre Dame, an MA in Counseling from University of Michigan, and an STM in Spirituality from the Jesuit School of Theology in Berkeley. We welcome once again to Common Threads, my cousin.
Thanks, Fred.
Hi there, Tom.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Yes, certainly. This is an interesting time for both of us, and I want to pay a little homage right now. Every time you've been on in the past, and it has been a few years since your last book, but every time we've been on, we've talked about our family connection, and in particular, your mother, Pearl Stella, who not only was my aunt, but my godmother, and she recently passed away, and we've been talking before the show that I had to miss the funeral due to travel plans, but I was able to come in and say goodbye to her shortly before her transition. She was 98 years old, and she was without a doubt the matriarch of our family, the extended family, and not just your branch of the family. It's quite clear. And the home in which she lived was a great gathering place for family. And I thought we would begin the show by you perhaps reflecting on what characteristics, what attributes of your mother do you see reflected in this latest book, CPR for the Soul? In what ways did she reflect that that divine light that you say we all have inside of us?
That's a good starting point, Brad. Thanks. I did the homily at her funeral and spoke to some of that, especially what I refer to as her down-to-earth spirituality. She would not have considered herself a spiritual person. She went to bed most nights with a rosary in her hand, but it was the work of her hands that was really embodied that spiritual presence, her service, her care for others, especially in the realms of cooking and gardening. She created an ambiance and an atmosphere that I think fed people's souls as well as their bodies. And So that mostly. She was a very down-to-earth, practical person. But that's what I see spirituality as being, not disembodied. That's spiritualism. Spirituality honors the human and the earthy and the everyday. And that's kind of what I try to do in the book, to say that we need to find the divine, however we understand that, within our everyday lives.
Would you say she did? Would you say that she was a little bit more Martha than Mary?
I would, absolutely. Yes, again, not a contemplative person, but one who engaged in life. And that's interesting that you bring that up, because the Greek word that describes Martha is marismos, which means pulled asunder. And that's very different than being busy. I would say that my mom was a busy person when she was capable, in her younger years especially, but not pulled asunder. Now, she didn't lose herself in what she did. So she was Martha, but had enough Mary in her to stay centered.
Sure. I'll tell you, as far as spiritual, encouraging my spiritual growth, let me tell you a little story. Nobody knows this. I've never told another soul this story. But I remember I was probably 12, 13 years old, and we were in your basement. I can't remember if this was the house on Wisconsin Street or the one in Rosedale. Regardless, it was just you. No, I mean, not you. It was just your brother, Michael, your mother, and myself. And it was a time of, certainly, of racial tension in Detroit. And I'm not ashamed to admit that my parents were not the most enlightened people when it came to racial relationships, the understanding of racism and all of that. They just weren't. And clearly in our family, there has been an evolution over the years of the understanding of again, racial relationships, racism, and all of that. But back, this is probably like the late 60s, there really wasn't a whole lot of that. And that was clearly reflected in me. I did not have the most enlightened understanding of race and all that goes with it. And I remember asking your mother in front of Michael. Michael was a teenager. He might have even been in college. And I said, kind of jokingly, what would you do if Michael brought home a black girlfriend? And I was expecting, simply because of who our family was at that time, what my parents were and all that, I just expected her to say something kind of amusing, perhaps, but definitely something that was, quite frankly, bigoted. And you know what? She didn't. She basically just said, well, we're all the same. And if Michael found someone he truly liked and brought her home, she would be welcome here. And I've remembered that to this day. Mm-hmm. Because it was so profound considering the circumstances. Today, if you ask anybody in our family what would happen if somebody brought somebody in from another race, it wouldn't raise an eyebrow. But back then, in certain circles, it would. And again, it affected me profoundly. And I believe that was probably the beginning of my growth as to how I understood things to happen.
I'm glad to hear that. She was that kind of person, just very accepting and open. I'm glad that touched you.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get a little bit into your book itself. Now, first of all, one of the reasons I believe that you've titled it CPR for the Soul is because of your work in the medical field, working for Centura. Can you tell us about that chapter in your life?
That work is... I continue to this day. I'm considered as a corporate chaplain for Centura Health, which, as you said, is a Catholic and Adventist health system. I once worked in one of their hospitals here in Colorado Springs, so I've been in that side of things. But right now I work with their support staff, that is, people who sit in cubes and look at computers all day. It's rare that any corporation, even faith-based or nonprofit, would hire somebody to play that role for their employees. So I consider myself fortunate, and the people I deal with seem to appreciate the fact that they have somebody on site who they can talk to. And I did The contents of this book are brief, like page and a half reflections that I write as part of my job. There are probably over 800 people that are in the various offices that comprise Centura. And there's no way I would meet all of them, because I'm just up there a couple times a month in Denver. But they all get these reflections via email. And so I decided the feedback was good enough that I wanted to compile them. And that is the book, basically. A series of reflections divided into 13 sections that speak to various aspects of life. And again, all of it trying to help people to realize that, what we long for most deeply is present every day of our lives. Not something we have to hope to encounter in some fashion after we die, which is probably the traditional sense of, you know, we meet our maker. But we meet our maker every day.
And you have to explain, how is it that Centura is a combination of both Catholic and Adventist, not theology, but the makeup, the corporate makeup is a combination of Adventists and Catholics?
Well, both have a long history in healthcare. And I'm not sure, there's about 20, 21 years ago that they came together. And I wasn't privy to what brought that about. But again, they have long traditions, respect each other's traditions religiously, but also, again, in terms of healthcare.
Lots of cornflakes served there?
Yeah, the Adventists are basically vegetarian. So even the cafeterias in their hospitals will not find meat.
And how about where you are, where it's a combination of Catholics and Adventists?
Well, yeah, there are, but there are, within the system, there are Catholic hospitals and Adventist hospitals.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
My next administration of them.
All right. My next question, I really would like to take a look at a retrospective of your career, because in the book, CPR for the Soul, you draw much upon not only your experience above and beyond what you're doing now, of course, you also draw from your previous books that we mentioned at the beginning of the program. And now that you are at the age you are, I'm wondering what you notice, what do you come away with after being in having the calling that you've had, which includes much pastoral work, the training of novitiates, leading retreats, preparing couples for weddings, for marriage. What are the common denominators that you see in terms of both the challenges that people tend to have, and also the glimpses of enlightenment that come back to you from the people you've worked with? And I realize it's a big question, but you can take it in small pieces if you'd like.
Mm-hmm. Well, first I would say that I draw from a variety of traditions in creating these reflections, east and west, and you know, the truth is everywhere, and the avenues to it are found in those various traditions. And in the dealings that I've had with people in a kind of pastoral way, as you just mentioned, you know, retreats and wedding preparation, hospice, is the dying process, we're all looking for the same thing. We're all hungry for the same sense of depth and oneness, I think. And so I would say that with all the people I've dealt with in various ways, I found that to be a common denominator.
How about in terms of, do you find yourself, or have you found yourself over the years with a particular challenge? That is to say, when people come to me for counseling, here's the one thing or the two things or even the three things that I'm constantly having to deal with, or these people are having to deal with this in their lives. Or I could be wrong. Maybe there isn't one, two, or three things. Maybe everyone is so completely different that they all have their different challenges. But I'm suspecting that someone in your position tends to deal with similar challenges with people.
Well, you know, the main challenge that I experience with people, especially when I do spiritual direction, which is more of a one-to-one kind of counseling situation, is, you know, these are people who are searching for and longing to grow spiritually. But I find that most of us are, in that regard, are our own worst enemy, meaning that we're trying too hard to become something we already are. People want to be more spiritual, more prayerful, more godly, and that's already a reality for everyone. It's our failure to be aware of that, which then results in our trying too hard to become, again, something that we already are, someone that we already are. So we get in our own way, I think, in the spiritual life. And that's, again, across denominations and religious traditions.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is my cousin Tom Stella, and we're talking about his latest book, CPR for the Soul. You talk about, in the book, I don't know if you use the term embracing our dark side, our shadow side, but it's something similar to that. Could you expound on that a little bit?
I would, yeah. That's there throughout much of the book. There is a kind of reactive sense, I think, that many people have to anything they feel is unacceptable to themselves or to others. That is our, what psychologists call the shadow, our pettiness, our self-interest, things we wish that nobody knew about us, but that are really there universally for all of us. And I think that the attempt, it's almost a knee-jerk reaction to overcome that, especially in religious traditions, you know, get over your selfishness, your jealousy, your impatience, your sin, basically.
You refer to them as dark gifts.
Pardon me?
You refer to them as dark gifts.
Dark gifts, yes. A former spiritual director of mine, that's a term that she used, meaning, what we call blessings in disguise. That the very things that we feel get in our way may be helpful to us in the long run if we learn to love ourselves as we are, to embrace the reality of our imperfection. Much more healthy, I think, than trying to overcome, that which we see as unacceptable.
But what about those things? For instance, we talked just a few minutes ago about my understanding of race and racism, which was clearly an imperfection. And I'm really happy that with a little bit of your mother's help, I got over that. I improved. What's the matter with saying, no, this is impeding me. I'm not going to be able to have the relationships I want to have. Nor am I going to be able to develop my own understanding of the divine presence within if I don't get over this. How do you make the decision that now I can hold on to this? I like this part of me. I know it's a little bit quirky. I know that it may not be a representation of any sort of human perfection or sainthood, but I like that. But this other thing, this is a real thing, and it bothers people. How do you come to that decision?
Yeah, well, I think it's a good distinction to make between aspects of ourselves that truly are problematic for us and for society, like prejudice, for instance, racism. There's that, and then there's the awareness of myself as someone who is imperfect. It's the acceptance of the imperfection rather than necessarily the particular thing that I'm trying to make a case for in the book. In other words, can I accept myself as somebody who has prejudicial attitudes that need to be changed? think objectively, really. They're not helpful to me or again, to society. But I think we go farther down that road of growth if we start from a place of self-love or self-acceptance. You know what I'm saying?
That, yeah.
I'm not affirming the problem. I'm affirming the person.
Sure.
And then when we affirm ourselves, we're starting our growth on rich soil, I think, where there's a possibility to come, for those good things to become rooted.
I think somebody who was very appreciative of the so-called dark gifts would be your dad. He we could do a whole show on that. He was his own person. He had an acceptance of whomever he was. And he, at least the way I saw him, he was rather joyful about it. Your dad had this, he could be very curmudgeonly if he wanted to be, just really to get people going. But I think he had a self-acceptance that was impressive and enviable. That's my take.
Yeah, my dad was a terrific person. He had a great joie de vivre. You know, he loved life. He had a great sense of humor, and he could be a tough guy. But I think he did accept himself as he was, and I think that has made him even more lovable.
Yes, absolutely. believe me, you know, in the family, people just talk about their experiences with Uncle Andy, and. You know, sometimes, especially if you worked for him at the family company, as some of us did, you might have a complaint here and there. But regardless, he was just impossible not to love. And a lot of it was really, upon reflection, if I didn't read this book, particularly this chapter on dark gifts, I would not have been able to verbalize it as I just have. But that's it. He had this tremendous level of self-acceptance, and that joie de vivre that he had was quite catchy.
Yeah, I can actually tell you a little story. I told this in a homily at my mom's funeral just a couple of weeks ago, that one of the things that characterized her life was that she spent a lot of time trying to rein him in.
And yes.
One of the circumstances was at Stella Products Christmas parties when he would grab the microphone and go on and on.
Yeah.
And she could be heard from a table near the front saying, Andy, that's enough, sit down.
Yes.
And the other was something you'll identify with, was what he called the trap.
Yes.
The trap was my father's version of a vision quest, trying to to initiate his nephews and their children into adulthood. He would invite them to his lap, and then he would squeeze them between his legs until they started to cry. You're getting great delight out of this. Of course, my mother would rush in from the other room to rescue the young victims. But that's indicative of both his way of going at life and of her response to it.
Yes, they made a wonderful team that way, because both were endearing. When you were in the trap, you didn't feel it terribly endearing, but certainly those of us who are trap survivors, I don't know if you know that, but we have a support group now. And those of us who are trapped survivors look upon that fondly, as much as we do your mother coming to the rescue. So it was, I don't know if they planned things in advance, whatever, but regardless, it was something to hold on to throughout childhood into adulthood.
You know, related to your reference to my dad, I opened the book, the introduction, with by saying, the fact that you are not dead is not sufficient proof that you're alive. Now, most people resonate with that right away. You know, we kind of go on half our cylinders sometimes. Well, my dad was somebody who went on all those cylinders most all the time. Somebody who was truly alive.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, again, you said that joie de vivre. And he could be quite engaged with just the small things in life, but just sharing a dinner with him. I remember one time my brother talking to me. I was here in Grand Rapids. He was in Detroit. And he said, I was over to Uncle Andy and Aunt Pearl's for polenta. And he says, I'll tell you what. He says, here's the best news. I go, what? He goes, Andy and Joe. Joe being Uncle Joe, Andy's brother, our common uncle. And just listening to them, listening to their colorful lives, listening to them argue, we felt as a sacred experience. It was just that way. So they're certainly missed, very missed, very much missed. And so far, no one in the family has taken their place. We are down to the wire right now, Tom. But of course, this is a wonderful conversation. I hope it's not too in or exclusive for everyone listening. It's the problem when you get a couple of Stellas together. But I'd like to invite you back next week, and we can talk more about your book.
Love to. Thanks.
You've been listening to Common Threads. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today has been Tom Stella, my cousin, who is the author of his latest book, CPR for the Soul. Please join us again next week here on WGVU.